AM Morning Show, 4759 AM. Judy Bunk is Blake Murphy and Ailish Korfar. Haven't talked a little bit of Blue Jays in a while. Spring training's still going on, but your Jays are headed home quite soon for that big home opener.
Sound less enthusiastic about spring training still being on.
Well, why? Because I read Ben Nicholson Smith's article, and he basically said it was a snooze fest as of late.
I will say this is the spring training that I can remember the least, like, being up in the air in terms of, like, roster spots, rotation spots, starting lineup spots.
Let's bring him in. Ben Nicholson Smith, Sportsnet MLB editor, co-host of Add the Letters, currently in Dunedin for spring training. We read your article. I'm going to summarize it. You've just been drinking margaritas, hanging out in the sun, and everything else is pretty much settled down there.
If only it were that simple. I mean, for the Toronto Blue Jays, things are going very well. For me, they're going well, too. So, I mean, I guess I can't really dispute that, although I have not been drinking margaritas nonstop.
Okay,
You can't be, because Arden told me the reason you were up at 6 a.m. is he's putting you through the arm workouts and everything. You're on the Arden Swelling plan now. The Arden Swelling plan for your arms now. Great podcast yesterday, by the way. Nice to see you guys back in person for the first time in a couple years.
Yeah, no, it's honestly been really nice. Like, we did so many Zoom podcasts, or Riverside is our program, and, you know, basically – doing it remotely for a long time, and now, you know, to be back in person doing the podcast, doing, you know, various chats, of course, connecting with players and coaches and people you know have seen, but certainly not in a while. It's been great to be back at it.
Yeah, I'm glad. I'll go in studio if we get to work at a bar.
Yeah. I was gonna say, JD, you want that set up, and I was gonna say to Ben that, like, I want that, and I want us to be back in studio, but the thing that Ben doesn't have is, like, we'll be back in studio and be like, man, 4 hours with JD is a lot. And Ben doesn't have that. It's just an hour with Arden. And
Arden's a real peach. You really want to be around Arden.
Yeah, well, other than
Arden
him talking about
hours.
Intermittent fasting or whatever he's on these days, it's probably fine. So, Ben, there's not a lot going on. Like, we haven't done a ton of Jays on this show since they convened down in Dunedin post-lockout, because everything's kind of set. Like, there are a few bullpen spots up for grabs, but we know the rotation. We know who the primary guys are going to be. Is there anything left that you're looking at down the stretch here? We got, what, 6 games left, I think? What are we watching here?
Yeah, I think that, as you said, I mean, really, this is a group that's taken shape already. It's a really good team. So you don't have a ton of those huge, you know, who's going to be that fifth starter? Who's going to win the closer battle? I mean, that stuff's basically set. So, you know, you have that final position player spot on the bench, and it looks like Greg Bird is at least the favorite to win that. I'm kind of curious as to, like, who might be the runner-up in that, because it's almost been presumed in certain circles around the team and among those discussing it that Bird is just going to be that guy. And I'm kind of like, well, what if one person needs, like, 5 days at the start of the season on the IL? And, you know, who would be that next person in line behind him? But, you know, those are the best kind of problems to have if you're a major league team at this kind of time of spring. And we have seen most years there are just bigger issues for players. And there's still a week to go, so you just want to stay healthy after the Blue Jays. But, yeah, they're trending in a good direction at this point.
Yeah, it's a terrific direction. And I guess I never get as up for these stories because, A, they don't send me like you guys where you're down there and living your best lives. I heard Brunt just got on the plane. He's heading down there tomorrow. But I just have never looked at baseball or really too many training camps that aren't the NFL as jobs are actually on the line or roles that matter are actually on the line. Maybe there have been a few years where that has been the case. We were trying to kind of talk ourselves into the Pearson story. That seems to have died down a little bit. But yeah, I thought the same thing as you. And I actually think that right now, Blue Jays fans are in a state where all of this stuff matters. It's the Leafs 6th to 7th defenseman corollary right now, right? Where you go, hey, it's not the most important thing, but people care. I think the Blue Jays are in that spot. And I have kind of been curious that I don't know who it is after Greg Bird. I don't know who would even be in the conversation. And yes, it's the last roster spot. I'm not trying to blow this into a bigger story, but who do you think that it could be? Who is that next sort of player up for you? What do you think they actually need from a depth position standpoint that they could actually benefit from? Like, who sticks out to you?
I wonder about someone like Malik Smith, just from, you know, pure speed. But, of course, with Tapia, maybe there's a bit of redundancy there. They sent out Otto Lopez and Josh Palacios. So, you know, clearly it's not like those guys are right on the cusp, even though they both had some time in the majors last year. You know, honestly, like, that's on my list of questions I'm going to ask Charlie Montoyo today, because I want to know how the Jays see it. And I think in a few months we're going to see, like, Moreno, or, you know, maybe it's a Groshans. Like, we'll see some minor league players pushing for that spot. But in the meantime, you have to get through those first few months, and you have to win a lot of games in the first few months and put yourself in a great position. So all these games matter. And when we're talking about the back end of the roster, really we're talking about it for, you know, the first couple of weeks, because it all changes so quickly. But those weeks matter.
Ben, those weeks also this year include a 27th and 28th man, at least for the first little bit. So I think it's pretty clear from your piece and from most of the beat writers that they're going to use those two extra spots on pitchers. They're like, Greg Bird is the fourth bench guy, and that's already with three catchers being kept. So I don't know that there's a ton. Like, I guess my interest with Greg Bird is, like, first of all, how much he plays, but also, if they get to the 26-man cutoff date, you know, do they run with a short bench because they're comfortable with that? That's a conversation for a month down the line when it's not a 28-man roster. But what do you think changed for them in terms of plan when we found out it was going from 26 to 28? Like, did that change the game plan with Pearson as a pseudo six starter slash long man, or did that just, hey, there's one more guy we don't have to expose to waivers in the bullpen yet?
Yeah, I think Pearson probably would have been on the team regardless. I think for someone like Reese McGuire or Ryan Borucki, you know, these guys who are out of options, even Greg Bird, like, I think that it creates just extra flexibility, because, you know, not only does it buy them a month, but with each successive roster spot that you add, it just becomes a little bit less pressure on. Like, deciding on the 40th is less important than deciding on the 15th. So I think that for the Jays, you know, they're likely, as you say, to really just keep that big pitching staff for the time being. And then it gives someone like a Greg Bird a chance to prove that this good spring is sustainable or not, because the reality is it's been 3 years since he hit a homer in the major leagues. Like, it's not like he was out there hitting bombs last year. It's been a while. So I don't, you know, as much as it's an amazing story, I don't want to get too swept up in what Greg Bird is.
Yeah, neither do I, even though Ennis in 2017 was the captain of this guy is legit and was starting to call him a Blue Jays killer. And he was, I'll never let him live down the Greg Bird thing. I'm a little terrified that Greg Bird actually becomes something, just in fear of Ennis trying to turn that take around from what is now 5 years ago. So I am curious as to who eventually bumps Bird, if it is a waiver pickup, if it's somebody that gets moved off of another roster, or if it is someone who is in the minor leagues. You kind of talked about it, but 10 pitchers, right? We could carry 10 pitchers. Yesterday I counted 6 locks, and then I guess I'm going to add Borucki to that list because you named him, and that makes a lot of sense. And then Pearson in the swing role, as Blake mentioned to me, that's 8. Who are the other two guys that are on the bubble here? Who are the other two bullpen arms? Because I think we're kind of getting to the point now where a lot of people, myself included, thought the bullpen's not done, the bullpen's not done. Is that where we might see another waiver wire pickup? Like, they've done this in the past where they pick through other teams' scraps throughout spring training. Is that something you anticipate, or are there actually some other guys that you like?
It's always possible, you know, for them to make a waiver claim. I remember when Anthopoulos was the GM, it felt like he would do that every year. At least that's the impression I have. Now, I think the in-house favorites, and, you know, I don't know this for a fact, right? And even the Jays are still deciding this stuff. So, you know, it's not like this is written in stone. But my impression would be that Julian Merriweather and David Phelps would probably be the in-house favorites to be in those spots. And Phelps, like Birdie's on the 40-man, but they have space there. So it's like they don't even have a 40-man crunch. Like, this is, you know, to be in this position where you're picking between some good choices and trying to finesse those last spots of the roster to set up the first couple of weeks of your season. Such a good spot. And, you know, just one other note is in the course of this decision-making, one of the reasons they're probably going to lean so much towards starting pitchers is because they play 30 games in the first 31 days after opening day.
So you look at the bullpen then, and for anyone who hasn't been, you know, doesn't know the six locks that JD's mentioning, we're looking at a bullpen of Romano, Yimi Garcia, Tim Meza, Adam Simber, Trevor Richards, and Ross Stripling. Those are, I think, your six locks, JD. And then Pearson in that kind of bulk role. And then Merriweather and Phelps as the last two guys in. And then, you know, you mentioned Brucky, Ben. Is Brucky in a spot where, like, if he had an option left, he'd be out of here? Because I know he hasn't been healthy and he hasn't had like a sustained, you know, sample at any point. I know he throws hard from the left side, but he's not a guy that's really blown me away. And it's not like Vasquez and Saucedo have either, but how thin is Brucky's leash with being out of options? And who's your bird friend?
I got a few of them out here. There's a good amount of them. It's with Brucky, it's aptly named for the Blue Jays team. So, you know, on the left side of the bullpen, I think you're right. Like, he's in a position where they just don't have a ton. Even Tim Meza had a great year, but, you know, it's not like he's done this for four or five seasons. So that helps Brucky's case, and the fact that he's out of options helps his case. If he had options and it was a 25-man roster and they were, you know, like it was a few years ago, he would have been on the outside looking in right now. But because they have those extra spots, then it helps his chances, and it helps the chances for a lot of guys who are kind of on that fringe, and allows the teams to kind of extend the tryout camp a little bit into the season. And then if they're up 7-1 against the Rangers, you use Ryan Brucky there and you see how he looks and if he's throwing strikes, because, you know, yeah, the velocity is a great starting point, but as you all know, I mean, you have to be attacking hitters within the zone.
Yeah. Are you fighting seagulls? Are you trying to, like, stop feeding the birds? Is that why you're up early? You're one of those little old ladies, little old guys that likes to go sit on the park bench early and just, like, feed and throw out the stale bread? Like, is that why you're out?
I'm up early because I was on breakfast television with Sid Sixero today. It's his birthday. Okay. So, it was a whole festivity. So that's why I'm up.
Okay, sorry, Mr. Celebrity. We'll question
Ben.
You
Ben, do you need a second to pick up that name you just dropped?
You guys asked me.
I know. And I was gonna throw more nonsense at you anyway. So I want to pivot off spring training stuff a little bit. So the Jays will be back here April 8th. They'll be at Rogers Center. We'll have a full house. We'll all be there. You know, some of us with press passes, like you, Ben. Some of us with big, tall, cold beers. Like me, JD, and Ailish. longer term, though, that Rogers Center that we're going into could look a little bit different. There's been a lot of reporting from you guys that there have been budget approvals and in the process of plan approvals for a lot of Rogers Center renovations. What is, short of, you know, like a better media buffet or whatever, what is the top of your Rogers Center renovation wish list?
Oh, man. You know, I think that there's definitely some room to do some things. And it's, you know, it's a functional stadium. It's obviously has some great teams and some great memories. But you look at, you know, that lower concourse, which is where they're going to do a lot of the work, just something as simple as pointing the seats really toward the pitcher's mound at home plate would be helpful, as opposed to, you know, it's a bit more towards shallow center field right now. That's okay. But, you know, it's improving that, adding some different spaces for fans. I think long-term, to me, I've always thought, like, it's such a well-located stadium. We've got a great downtown in Toronto. We've got Lake Ontario right there. Like, it really is a great setting. And sometimes you don't feel connected to the surroundings. So I just personally, I would love to see them connect it a bit more. That's probably a bigger project, maybe longer term. But in the short term, I think there are ways to really celebrate the team's history. I would love to see that. I think they've got a great history. And there's just not a lot of acknowledgement of that right now. So I think that's one area, as well as kind of keeping it up to date and making sure that fans really do have some easier access, ease of mobility around, and some different ways to enjoy it. So, you know, your experience can differ if you're with little kids compared to if you're with seniors, compared to you're having a few beers and watching it with your friends.
That's long term. Short term, Ben, you had mentioned in talking about Berucki, like, oh, what if they're up 7-1 on the Rangers or something like that? Opening weekend next weekend, if they're not up at least 7-1 on the Rangers by the time I'm done my first beer, disappointing home opener. Really looking forward to that. Looking forward to your continued coverage from down in Dunedin. Enjoy the sunshine, man. We really appreciate you taking the time this morning, even if it was only because you had the bigger thing to do first.
I never said one was bigger than the other. I am always happy to join you guys, and I'm happy to talk to you anytime. So thanks for having me on. Have a great show.
Great. Thanks, Ben. That was Ben Nicholson-Smith, Sportsnet MLB editor, co-host of At the Letters. Check out his latest at Sportsnet. Although he did just kind of one sentence it with us, which is there's not a lot going on there in terms of what's going to be decided between now and April 8th for the Blue Jays. But I'm sure now that he's down in Dunedin, he's going to have a lot of good stuff coming your way. And the At the Letters podcast with him and Arden is always a must listen.
That's what I would have written, by the way. I would have written that if I was down there in the sun in Florida. All my pieces would be like, nothing's really happening. You guys don't really need to worry about it.
I don't need to go to the ballpark today.
Here's the guys that might be around it and whatever. Follow at Shai Davidi, Ben Nicholson. Yeah.
Josh Palacios, exit velocity, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Some people are saying the Pearson stuff has been pretty quiet, though, I got to say, in terms of just hype. And I don't know whether that's a big time positive or if that's supposed to scare me. Like, I know there have been, hey, he looks good reports, but there hasn't been anything of, hey, Pearson's been blowing people away, or that I've seen anyways. I don't know, Blake, you're closer to it than I am because you're doing the pregame shows, but I've been a little surprised at the lack of Pearson storylines in a spring training where he's really the only story of consequence.
And I do think some of that is probably the 28-man roster for the short term, where that makes that decision really easy, right? He's only had two appearances, and they haven't been the best of appearances. He allowed 3 runs over 4 1/3. But on Saturday, when I did the pre and post game, like, he got kind of – it was one of those innings where there are two bad plays behind you that aren't errors, but they should have been made, and then he gives up a 700-foot home run, which is always probably going to be the case with Nate Pearson, because the harder you throw it in, the harder it comes out. But he's also struck out 6 guys. His control has been pretty good. He's done multiple innings in every relief appearance in a way that makes me think, like, yeah, they're going to keep him not stretched out for a starter, but it wouldn't surprise me if the odd time they want to get Ryu or Kikuchi an extra day of rest, that he starts and goes 3 or 4 innings or whatever the day dictates, and you have Stripling coming in behind him. I think they'll use him multi-inning out of the pen. I just don't think 2 appearances is – and they haven't come out and said, yes, this is how we're going to use him. They just kind of said, well, a bulk role is possible. We see him as a starter still, but he hasn't thrown a lot of innings the last couple of years, so – a bulk role maybe makes sense, and it's the best of both worlds. So obviously velocity is always going to be the first thing you look at with Nate Pearson. The one encouraging sign from his 2 outings is I do think he's been controlling that heat a little bit, as he sits around like 97-ish instead of 104 or whatever. Ailish, it's time for something to chew on. Brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum.
What do you got for us?
Let's stick with the baseball world. And let me introduce you to potentially the next big name in Major League Baseball. My heritage, Bulgaria. The first ever Bulgarian baseball player to ever sign with the United States Major League team, Jonas Aleksandrov, the 17-year-old catcher and outfielder from the champion Sofia Blues. Wow. That's how my mother would say it as a Bulgarian. Sofia signed a 6-year contract. He is a massive, thick killer out there. He's a big guy.
Okay.
He is tall and strong. He comes from a family with a rich history of athletic parents. His father, a decathlon fighter, his mother a hurdle player. Not sure what those mean, but maybe this translation is a little off.
I think it's just hurdles. She ran the hurdles.
She hurdle player. I don't think that's a little Bulgarian hurdles, translator.
Like, that's you guys. I'm hurdles player. It's like, okay, buddy.
our boy here led the league with 19 home runs. They won the Cup of Bulgaria. He has signed with the Cubs. It's going to be a future. Is Bulgaria the new, dynasty of MLB players? We'll have to wait and see. My guy Jonas could be the next big thing, and he's Bulgarian. So shout out to my heritage.
Yeah, we got that. We got that he's Bulgarian. I think that you referenced that 30 times. I love that you did that.
I gotta make sure you know why.
That's something to chew on. It sounded like you were just like stoned in high school. I'm like, where were you? Okay. What were you just doing? You're like, he's like Bulgarian and he ran he played the hurdles. It's like you went through. We got a very detailed.
Tough to find news about this guy.
I can't tell if you were sounding like you were making up an excuse or if you were inventing a person. Like, Ailish, I heard that you're dating somebody now. And you go, yeah, he's
Bulgarian.
His parents were from a long line of athletes. Like, okay, that was good.
I will say, a 17-year-old catcher. Yeah, well, I don't have his stats, but
come
he
on,
is a 17-year-old.
I thought you would have it.
He's a 17-year-old catcher who's 6'4", 230.
That's what I'm saying. He's a big boy.
As a fan base that has gotten behind Alejandro Kirk as the 5'10" version or 5'9" version of that, big paws on a puppy. As they might say, I don't know. There's got to be power in that bat. If I know anything about Bulgarian athletes, the first thing I think of is power. It's powerlifting. It's
Miro.
Strength. It's exactly. It's Miro. And now it's Jonas Alexandrov.
If I think about anything in Bulgarian sports, it's nothing at all. Because
have one guy to follow.
Honest to God, I think Ailish is the most famous Bulgarian athlete. So I'm pretty sure this guy is fighting with you neck and neck.
You know, Georgiev, he's Bulgarian too.
Oh, right. I forgot about that.
You say this now, JD, and then he's going to be down like 3 years from now, once he's finally ready to play in the minors, he'll be with the Myrtle Beach Pelicans, and you'll be like, I was on this Cubs prospect from day one. You can go back and listen to the podcast. We said this guy was the next big thing.
All right.
You've done with F1 and soccer, you'd be like, I'm Canada's number one Jonas Alexandrov.
No, I will always be number one. You can be 1B.
No, okay? Listen, this is a corner that I will vacate, all right? I will vacate this corner. I love this. This is my favorite something to chew on that we've ever done. And I can't wait for Bulgarian people to be angry in my mentions. This is going to be great. I'm thrilled about it.
That was something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats. A lot of good stuff from Ben Nicholson Smith to chew on as well. And we'll have plenty throughout the show. Luke Fox and Justin Bourne at 8 and 9, respectively, to talk Leafs. Tim Bontemps at 9:30 to whip around the NBA. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to whip around the NBA ourselves. I took part in Tim Bontemps' regularly scheduled MVP straw poll. We'll talk about those results. We'll talk about 76ers Bucks from last night. And, hey, your Lakers no longer in a playoff spot, absolutely embarrassed without LeBron last night against the Dallas Mavericks. We'll talk about all that next on the Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590, The Fan.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays, Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fan Morning Show. Sports at 590, The Fan. JD, Blake, and Ailish. We spent the break reading the names of the most famous Bulgarian athletes, and we have landed on the name Blagovest Stoyanov as the best of the best. And I also like Ognjana Petrova, both Olympic bronze medalists. So I'm sorry to the rich history.
Put some respect on us.
Bulgaria is a powerhouse in getting bronze at canoeing. I gotta tell you, like, bronze at canoeing. If you're born and raised in Bulgaria, you got a real shot at a bronze at canoeing. I got to tell you, like, that's the pinnacle of Bulgaria. Do look, they just have statues of canoes all around Bulgaria? Like, look at the list. It's so deep. It's so deep. Bronze. Everyone's bronze.
Here's the key. I mentioned earlier that the first thing I think of with Bulgaria is power. And we were also talking about Miroslav Barnyshev, or Rusev, as you may have known him. And I'm just picturing them all being that jacked. And it's like, you could be a gold medal winning canoe country if you guys would go through a cutting phase. But all Bulgaria does is bulking phases, all these enormous canoers who are too jacked and it's too much weight to get gold. It's just bronze only. Elite athletes, Bulgaria. But they're... The same problem I run into of being too jacked sometimes.
Yeah, me too.
That slows you down.
Yeah. So anyway.
Ooh, boy.
Bulgaria, good job by you with all your bronzes in canoeing. You're killing it. Yesterday, Blake sent us an article that is up on ESPN right now. It's written by our buddy Timmy Goodtimes, who's coming on later in the show. Tim Bontemps.
Tim Bontemps?
Tim Bonton, for those of you, a guy
French
who
Canadian pronunciation.
I think that his small picture on ESPN actually makes him look like Tim Robinson, and I like seeing that, like picturing him as Tim Robinson writing all these NBA columns. But yes, he has NBA MVP straw poll, Nikola Jokic, Joel Embiid, and where the race stands with 2 weeks left in the season. And Blake, I mentioned to you earlier this morning that I have been kind of obsessively watching the Denver Nuggets lately. It's a weird addiction of mine. I've been watching a lot of Pistons, and I've been watching a lot of Nuggets, and that's an oddity. But that's because that's kind of the way I'm leaning in both award races. I'm really not trying to be Mr. Zigzag, because apparently the poll really reflects the Jokic's MVP thing. And I think there's a case to be made for three guys, and those three guys are obviously all at the very top of the quarter poll. Or the straw poll, sorry. But where do you have it right now? Because it has now become, I don't know, you said this is a very good indicator usually of where the voters are at. I don't think it's a hot take anymore that Jokic is MVP. And to me, it just actually kind of feels like if he can stay out of the play-in game with Denver, that he's now going to win this award.
And he's got the two-game cushion on the play-in game. So For those who don't know, the way Tim does this is he polls 100 NBA writers. The actual MVP vote is also 100 NBA writers, but it's not the same 100. Like, I have a vote in Tim's poll, but I don't have an actual award vote. And historically, when Tim does these things, and my old pal Eric Green at The Athletic gets a vote this year. I'm like, had I stayed there, I'd probably have a vote instead of him, or we share a vote or something. It's brutal. It's unbelievable. But so historically, the third straw poll of the season tracks pretty well with what the actual results end up being. There are 8 or 9 games left here where the races are tight enough, 1, 2, 3, and the races are tight enough, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You can go pretty far down. 13 different guys got top 5 votes in the latest straw poll that Tim did. So it's very close enough that I think things could swing. I had it. Sorry, go ahead, Ailish.
No, I was going to say, wasn't it the last 4 times the person that was leading this poll won the actual MVP?
I believe so. Which is, I mean, look, a lot of these voters are probably the actual voters. Tim doesn't publish the list or whatever. So I had it chalk. So this is also, like, we submit it blind. We don't get to see anyone else's or anything like that. So I had it the way that the results turned out. I had it Jokic, Embiid, Giannis, 1, 2, 3. I think those three are very, very close. I think those three, you could put them in whatever order, and I wouldn't object to it too much. It got super interesting at 4-5. I threw up in my mouth, but I gave Jason Tatum a fifth-place vote. And I had Steph as the fourth-place guy, but he's not going to have enough games to make my hypothetical ballot by the end if he misses the rest of the season. But the nudge there was, first of all, I had him in my top 5 before, and Golden State completely falling apart without him and looking awful. It just kind of hammers home how important he is. I had it Jokic, Embiid, Giannis, Steph, Tatum, and then I think Ja would have been my next man up, or Chris Paul.
I don't know. I never really care about how deep it goes. I just care about who the MVP is and who's in the conversation for the actual award.
That's like, not true, because you asked me last time around, like, hey, what did you put Chris Paul on your ballot? Like, yep. I think Chris Paul should get some down ballot votes because
I thought Chris Paul should be the MVP. That's the you misunderstood me. I thought at that point he had a shot, but
and he was on my ballot last time around. But I will say it's obviously totally fine to only care about the actual winner of the award. But MVP shares are like a thing, like not an official stat or anything. But I know you're a big Book of Basketball guy, JD. And, you know, hey, how many times did this guy get votes for the MVP is a decent indicator of like, okay, what was this guy at his best? And you go on a guy's basketball reference page and you can see things like MVP award shares and stuff like that. So getting down ballot votes does matter when we're looking back and contextualizing. So.
I just think it's a deep dive NBA fan thing, whereas for our context, I only care about the NBA MVP this year. And I find this race to be fascinating because it's three centers. It's three centers and it involves two guys that were neck and neck for this award last year. I think that Embiid got a long season narrative push, and this actually reminds me a little bit of F1, where you're looking at it and going, it's kind of back and forth, and this is Lewis and Max, and this is coming right down to the finish, and that these last couple games are really going to matter between the two of them. However, I'm curious about this straw poll and how it gets reflected, because Blake, you and I spend a lot of time talking about this, which is a lot of voters, they're not watching every single game. And I'm not going to profess to either, right? We've got a very busy schedule. We're watching Leafs, we're watching Blue Jays, we're watching all kinds of different stuff. And so I really have to try to carve out time to watch second screen experiences or to try to watch highlights, go through the Dawkins videos of watching a little bit closer of everybody's highlights.
Want to talk MVP? Dawkins is, since we came into this job, the absolute MVP of my basketball consumption.
Right. And so I'm watching a lot of these videos and I'm trying to figure this out and I'm taking this into account. Embiid, I thought, had this incredibly strong narrative push because not only did Philadelphia have drama, they didn't have Simmons, and he just was carrying through out the season. And Embiid, if he wins this award, I'm definitely not going to look at it as unjustified. But where I go with the writers and where I go with the people that aren't watching, I don't know how you could go against Nikola Jokic because I feel like he would win in both categories. If you're just a stats nerd, win shares, box plus minus, value over replacement, so VORP. All these stats, and I don't go deep diving like Blake into 538. I just open up the basketball reference page like an old school person.
But it doesn't matter. Anywhere you go, Jokic is ahead by a mile.
Anywhere you go, Jokic is ahead by a mile. You just look at the playmaking, the scoring ability, the defense, the rebounding. It's all Jokic. The other part of this is that I think how I'm feeling, and I don't necessarily have this year to year, or it's not a binary way that I look at the NBA. But I do look at the best player and the MVP as you have to have team success because you have to be a winner. You have to be able to carry a team. Basketball is very much about who your best player is. But this year, because of the field, and I mean this both with the rookies and with MVP and just with the depth of field in the NBA, where it's not a traditional class of, wow, this team is so incredibly dominant. The Suns are probably the best team in the NBA, and especially when they get Chris Paul back. If you look at them, you're going to say the Suns are the team. But Devin Booker's not the MVP, and there's not even like a remote case to make Devin Booker the MVP. Jokic is just doing so much with so little around him. I referenced to you, Blake, his net rating right now. It's insane, his value to the Denver Nuggets. If Jokic is not playing on this team, I think that they're in the we're going for the number one lottery ball pick. Who's the second best player right now on
Aaron Gordon?
I was just going to say
Morris?
It's Aaron Gordon or Monty Morris, and they're leaning on Bones Highland. They have not had Jamal Murray. Maybe they get him back. They haven't had Michael Porter. Maybe they get him back. But Jokic is just doing so much with so little to have these numbers. I understand there's voter fatigue. I understand people want to reward Embiid because his career, we all feel like, is not going to have an incredibly long shelf life. And there's always this kind of undercurrent of, well, we need to celebrate Embiid while he's here because he's so special. He's such a physical specimen. But Jokic is just the guy to me. I just don't know what every which way I look at it, unless you're taking the fact that the Sixers are two seeds higher in the Eastern Conference, I don't know what the case is supposed to be for Embiid that he's having the better season than Jokic.
I feel like when I was trying to develop a take on this yesterday, it was very difficult for me because I feel like Embiid did a lot of what Jokic did before right now. Like, he carried the 76ers throughout the Ben Simmons drama. And I think last time we talked about this, I was high on Embiid more because I thought that really added to his case. Even last night, I was down to, okay, who would I give the MVP to? And then Giannis puts up 40 on Embiid, and that head-to-head obviously matters a lot. So even last night, something changes this tight down the stretch. And maybe I don't watch enough Nuggets, which I don't. I'm more concerned about what's happening at the top of the Eastern Conference. So there's also the case of, like, Embiid has helped the 76ers get to a higher place. You know, a six-seed Nuggets is how do you value where your team is. And I think we have this discussion all the time when we think about an MVP. Is it the best player in the league? Is it the best player that helps their team the most? Like, it's really difficult. And I think we have this a lot in sports, even last night. So yeah, things can change quite a lot. I feel like I was high on Embiid for most of the season. Now things have changed really quickly down the stretch. But when you do look at the head-to-head between, I think it was Embiid and Jokic, Embiid had a better showing against that team. So does that matter? Like, when we talk about Scottie Barnes and Evan Mobley, when the head-to-head, does that matter when you're trying to make that final decision? There's just so many factors that come into voting who should get this that I'm flip-flopping even last night. So, I mean, it's going to be exciting. At least that gives us a lot more incentive to watch all of these games down the stretch as if you needed any.
If the Sixers end up with the one seed, then I think you give it to Embiid. If they fall below that, I don't think you can. If Jokic is in the seven seed, as in a play-in game, it's harder to justify. Both guys are carrying their teams. There's no question. Like, there's absolutely no question. But James Harden is a significantly better player than anybody that's on Denver right now. And if you look at their season as a whole, even before they traded away James Harden, the team is much better all season long than
Tyrese Maxey would be Jokic's best teammate.
Yeah, no, unquestionably he would be. I think it's razor thin. My point is not that Embiid is not a deserving MVP. I thought he had the award locked up for large stretches of the season. Just that the longer we've gone into this sucker, the more it has just become apparent that, okay, if you're making a statistical case, it's Jokic. If you're doing the eye test case, you're saying it's basically even because both guys are just so incredibly special, except the fact that Jokic's playmaking is just so out of this world different than, like, anybody else in the NBA. And watching him and the way that he puts his teammates in positions to succeed is so incredibly invaluable. But then when you look at him, Blake, this is kind of what I wanted to ask you about, is I would say that what would be the tipping point for Embiid, would be making the case that his defense is what should give him the edge. And this is one I don't really have the answer to, because eye test-wise, Embiid is maybe the best defensive player in the NBA, but the numbers actually back up Jokic's defense as being better.
Yeah, so I wouldn't say Jokic is a better defender than Embiid, but I do think that the way he looks and his early career reputation it's similar to the Jonas Valanciunas thing, right? Where by the end of Jonas's time in Toronto and now in New Orleans and Memphis between that, he's a really good defender. It's just stylistically, it fits a certain style, and you have to play a certain way around that. And that's the case for Jokic. He's a huge dude, and he thinks and sees and feels the game at a level that we've maybe never seen from a non-point guard before. So, yeah, and again, there's nobody around him. Like, Denver is a league-average defense, and I know of the pieces they have left, there are more defense-first guys than offense-first guys. But when we talk about, like, impact and on-off stuff, like, the Nuggets are 7 points per 100 possessions worse on defense when Jokic is off the floor. That's a way bigger impact than an Aaron Gordon or a Monte Morris or an Austin Rivers or Nate, like, pick your guy on the Nuggets. And yeah, a little bit of that admittedly is DeMarcus Cousins, the contrast stat there. So the one other thing that I think can be – so their raw per game stats, Jokic is at 27-14-8. Embiid's at 30-11-4. The impact stats support Jokic. I think the eye test, Embiid feels a little bit more dominant and looks like a bigger defensive presence. But in a race this close, another factor is Jokic played seven more games. And when two guys are basically tied, that's a good hair splitter.
Who has a better schedule? Going to say, who has the better schedule that's going to bode best for them over the next seven games? Does that matter?
It matters in that I think if Denver falls into the play-in or if Philadelphia runs away with the one seed,
Denver has two games against the Lakers. That's all I know, and those are two wins.
Yeah, it's a really good closing argument, right? And I think the cool thing about this MVP race is we're not going to see a situation where, Giannis sits out the odd game and Steph sits out the odd game in previous years. Embiid and Jokic, both their teams have a lot to play for. Philadelphia has a pretty cake schedule down the stretch. Like, the Raptors are the best team they play from here on out. Denver, like you said, they have the Lakers twice. They have Memphis and Minnesota, so not the easiest of schedules. And that Towns matchup is always a really fun one for Jokic. But, yeah, I think less so the opponents and more so where you end up in the standings. Because let's be honest, like you said, JD, not everyone watches every one of these games to discuss and to really go deep on these guys. Stats help, and look, it's similar to how coaches have explained how they do their all-star ballots. Probably if you're not covering one of these guys every day or even on a weekly basis or whatever, the first thing you probably do is fire up the standings page, right? I would say MVP voters who are relying on things other than their current feel, it's you open up the standings page, you open up points per game first. Those are the two things you look. So if Philly or Denver is a little higher there, and the Russ Westbrook triple-double MVP season was an anomaly where usually guys don't win MVPs if their teams don't win 50 games. The Nuggets they project to win like 49.6. So I think the 50-game threshold is an important one for the Nuggets. So I think how the teams do is a very relevant factor here.
I don't love MVP award race discussions from the standpoint of it always sounds like you're tearing a guy down when you're propping somebody up.
No, it's two historic seasons.
It is. Embiid has been spectacular. And again, there's actually – it's sort of strange the way that just Giannis Antetokounmpo has essentially been boxed out of this conversation. Like, if we were being realistic and we were taking into account the value of the number one seed, or we were talking about voter fatigue, well, then Giannis potentially finishing with the number one overall seed, the way that he's played this year, and, yeah, just his value –
the quietest 30 points, 12 rebounds, and 6 assists per game in the history of the world. And he does all that in 32 minutes.
Exactly. And this used to be the case for Giannis, was the what if he played more, and now we just don't even do that anymore. But Vegas has, right now, Giannis has plus 1,400 to win the award. The other two guys are minus 140, plus 125. So it does feel like there is still a pretty strong narrative drive here, and I think that can sustain Embiid. I really agree. Ailish, the schedule matters in the sense of who they might play or what the matchups, but I think both guys are clearly going to get their numbers when they're playing. Like, they're just both number freaks. You're not going to see, like, the Rookie of the Year award is actually kind of funny because Barnes and Mobley both can have nights like the other night against the Celtics where Barnes puts together 10-4-4 with a bunch of turnovers, a bunch of fouls, and actually has a bad night, and it sways the way that you look at him. Whereas these two guys are not going to have multiple games of, oh, wow, look at what a horrible game it was from Embiid or from Jokic. I just look at this right now and say the difference between the standings is going to be monumental because there are just so few ways to split up this race. And I think people want to give the award to Embiid. They love Embiid. He's a great representative of the game. Getting a Joel Embiid MVP speech and what that looks like is almost worth giving him the award, and seeing how he would act being the league's MVP, seeing some of the tweets that we would get from Embiid. Embiid,
like,
is
the
most exciting.
He's absolutely going to bring Sam Hinkie up on stage with him.
Yes, Embiid is the most exciting MVP candidate. But I really think that if we're just looking at what is around them, what the team success is, and the actual individual accomplishments of the year, they do tend to tilt towards Jokic in just about every single way. And that's been kind of the theme of the way that I'm looking at award races this year, is through the lens of the way we kind of evaluate Coach of the Year oftentimes, which is either you're the very best and you have the best record, or who did the most with the least. And it's why I also think Cade Cunningham is the Rookie of the Year. I watched Cade again last night, dropping 30-plus points.
Fickle. Your mind's changing.
I think
changing.
That if you go with Barnes or Mobley, I have zero problem with it. But last night, it was very much a night of, we need to stop pretending like Rookie of the Year is a team success thing. And if anything, to me, it's a bit of a detractor. The Raptors
One time since 2009 or whatever it is I said on the show the other day, where a guy from a winning team has gotten Rookie of the Year.
Exactly. And that's why it's very strange to me this season, where we're doing the evaluation, and we've been guilty of it too, but I mean league-wide, I've seen the same trend, which is which one of these guys is impacting the higher winning team, and they're all split and they're all very close. It's an incredibly special rookie class. To win this is an awesome award. I think Barnes is a deserving candidate, and he's a deserving winner. If Scotty Barnes wins this thing, I'm not going to look at that and go, wow, what a robbery. I'm going to go, you know what? Barnes deserves it. Barnes deserves it for a lot of different reasons. I'm just looking at what's around Cade. I pulled a couple of numbers in terms of what his team success is without Cade versus with Cade. He is the Pistons. They only have 20 wins this year, right? So it's like, okay, well, they're not the best team, but they're 2-14 in the games he hasn't played. This is also the case against Cade, right? Where you go, well, why would you vote for the guy that's missed 16 games when we're looking at such a tight Rookie of the Year award? His team, when he actually plays in games, and it's not exactly like they're world beaters, but they're 18-41. The Cavs are 3-5 without Mobley, and the Raptors are 5-3 without Barnes. So you could make the case again that Barnes and Mobley have been healthier, they've been more impactful in the close race, they've played more games, Cade has missed too many. I'm here for that too. But the idea of those two guys impacting a winner, I think it's a little overblown compared to what Cade Cunningham is doing for a dreadful Pistons team and how special his second half has been since he's gotten healthy and started to have momentum. The true shooting percentage is not great. You wish that that was a little bit better. But overall, Cade Cunningham, if we're just doing this on the balance of, hey, what does the Rookie of the Year award represent? It's the best rookie. It's the most talented rookie. And I think that's Cade.
Yeah, I think it's really close, 1, 2, 3, and I wouldn't argue with any order between those guys. I think the reason that team success has come into it this year is because this is a unique Rookie of the Year. Like, there was the Simmons-Mitchell year where both of those teams were good, and there was the stupid narrative of, like, is Simmons actually a rookie? But other than that, there's never been a year where we look at team success for Rookie of the Year, because this never happens. Teams don't turn around like Cleveland and Toronto have. Teams don't have rookies playing, you know, top 12 minutes in the entire league on a team that blows expectations away. So I don't think it's become part of the conversation because this is like Rookie of the Year is now going to be Rookie MVP. I just think this is a totally special year in terms of Mobley and Barnes. I mean, I said it when we were teeing this up last week, is Cade's going to get votes. Cade's at like 17-7-7 or something like that now. And Barnes and Mobley have both missed a little bit of time. So the missed games maybe isn't a thing. I think it's going to be a really fun final stretch here for those guys. Hopefully the Cade thing last night isn't serious. But yeah, I think you can make a case for any of those guys. And they're going to finish 1, 2, 3 in some order. And it'll be fine. And that's the same for Jokic, Embiid, and Giannis. But it's certainly
how do you think it's
going to
finish, though? I actually think that
I think it's going to finish Mobley, Barnes, Cade.
I think that there's incredible value on Barnes right now. And I'll tell you this. You said it. Not everybody watches all the games. And so Barnes on total is going to have the statistical case. And I think in such a close race, people are going to tilt and go, he played the most games. And he's on a team that's winning the most. He's an incredible defensive player for his age. And there are nights where he is a central figure to the success. I think it's going to tip Barnes into winning the award. I would give my vote as of today to Cade. Maybe tomorrow I'll give it to Scotty. That's how close it is, honest to God.